not necessarily the most polished performer in the ring, but his incredible charisma was making him, as the Junkyard Dog, one of the hottest heroes in wrestling. With JYD, Cowboy had a special person with incredible strength and a rare presence that Watts and his booker, Buck Robley, planned everything else around. They wanted to continue to create the best possible issues for JYD to overcome, issues that would resonate on a human level with the fans. A couple of years before, they got JYD to the top of the business when the Freebirds, Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Buddy Roberts, blinded JYD using their hair removal cream that accidentally got into Dog's eyes. To the fans, the villainous Birds had deliberately blinded their hero. But Hayes, an awesome talker, swore it was an accident, that they had been trying to remove his hair, but JYD moved, causing the cream to go into his eyes. The Freebirds' denials left the Mid-South brass unable to prove their intent, which meant the dastardly threesome wouldn't be sanctioned. JYD's only justice would come when his friends took on the Freebirds in bouts that drew thousands of fans hoping to see JYD's friends exact revenge on his behalf. Of course, no one was able to avenge him, so months later, Dog himself came back for a match with Freebird mouthpiece Michael Hayes. JYD, still blind, got a dog collar bout in which both men wore leather collars that were connected by a length of chain. JYD couldn't see Hayes, so he needed a way of getting a hold of him. That match headlined the New Orleans Superdome, drawing more than 30,000 fans, Mid-South's biggest crowd ever. I grew to learn that number was close, but maybe not perfectly accurate, as wrestling was known for trumpeting crowd figures that were always embellished to some degree. Watts knew the old rule of wrestling and the promotion in general. Say it enough times, and it moves from fantasy to fact. The old promoters all did it. Fritz Von Erich did it in Texas, Vern Gagne did it in Chicago, and Watts did it in the Superdome. Figuring out how to best meet Bill's advertising needs also coincided with a realization I've made about several of my other radio ad clients. If I ran my own ad agency, I could create and broker my own ad packages to bring to media outlets myself. This would save my clients 15% or more based on what they were paying for local ads in each market, and I would come out way ahead financially. It took me a couple of years to pull everything together, but I got my own company on its feet, and I was finally doing better, feeling better, getting to enjoy my normal life. My second marriage was somewhat more stable because I was somewhat more settled, too. We had a new child, a new house, and a fresh start. I ended up with about a dozen clients, one of which was Mid-South Wrestling. "What did you think of the show last week?" Cowboy asked over a quick coffee. I was now renting office space from Bill in his building, and it wasn't unusual for us to meet up to go over new ad ideas or for him to deliver a check for work completed. "I liked it," I said. "How would you like to come to work for me, Jim?" he asked before I could finish my sentence. I was stunned, but my body filled head to toe with a rush of adrenaline. Just at the mere thought of it, I wanted more than anything to get back to the business I loved, to get back to ringside, to get back on the road that aged me. Before I could answer, Watts continued, "Things are getting bigger, and I want you to come on board as the director of marketing for Mid-South Sports." "Yes," I said immediately. "Yes?" he asked, a little surprised at the speed at which I replied. "Yes," I repeated. I knew it wasn't the job I wanted. I knew it was an offer that I could sell to all people who wanted me to settle down, my wife included. I was back in the wrestling business, but not back in the wrestling business. I'm the marketing guy. I'm back in, but not back in. But I was back in. Chapter 16. Back in Mid-South, 1984. It felt good to be home. TV tapings were in the Irish McNeil Boys Club in Shreveport, Louisiana, with Reeser Bowden as ring announcer and Boyd Pierce as host of the TV show. I knew I'd have to wait for my opportunity to get back in as part of the show. It might take months, but I was willing to wait years. "You still interested in broadcasting, Jim?" Cowboy asked straight off the bat. "What?" "You heard me." "Yes, yes, I did hear him. Loud and clear. You bet your ass I'm still interested," I replied. "We'll start you back as a ring announcer. You have experience there. Then we'll see how you go," he said as he walked off. I looked around the studio. The ring. The cameras. It was small. Dark. But felt like home to me. I knew what other people wanted me to be. People I loved. But I also knew what I wanted to be. Or, more importantly, where I wanted to be. And that was in the wrestling business. Within weeks, Watts was looking for more ways to utilize me at televised events. My advertising and promotion of his events was going well, and he told me he wanted another set of eyes and ears on his product, basically, that he valued my opinion. His words gave me confidence, especially as I was making my return to the business. The weeks built into months, and time blurred as I submerged back down the rabbit's hole. Within a year, Cowboy had another quiet conversation with me as I walked into the studio and he was on his way out. "You heading somewhere?" I asked, as it was unusual to see Cowboy leave when the day was only starting. "I want to try something new in the promos, Jimmy," he said. "I want you to be the interviewer. You're already doing the publicity, so you know what we need to put out there." I was thrilled, but a bit shocked. These local promos were the lifeblood of the company. They were our best, most direct route to the fans at home, who we were trying to convince to buy our live event tickets. And those ticket sales were the only revenue stream we had as a company. If no one came to see the shows, then no one in the company got paid. "Whatever you need for me to do," I replied. "You can show me what you want. I'm not going to be involved," he interrupted. "You're in charge."
"Me?"
"Yeah, you," he replied as he tried to leave.
"Just me?"
"Yeah, just you." I stopped talking as some of the wrestlers walked past us in the building. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Won't other people mind if I start telling them what to do?" I whispered. "Hopefully," he laughed. "Shake things up a bit." And with that, he was gone. I'd only been assisting with the promos for a few months and doing some on-air work since I returned. I worked faster than Reeser, which saved Cowboy some money, which meant he liked me doing the job more. As my value grew to Bill, my relationship with one of his other main lieutenants was getting worse. Grizzly Smith had become one of Bill's backstage agents shortly after Bill split off from Leroy. We never really got along, and that situation only got worse when Cowboy started entrusting me with greater responsibility. Grizz started seeing me, the guy he drove out of Leroy's company, as a threat to his position in Bill's inner circle. Getting the nod from Cowboy to be in charge of the promo tapings wasn't going to do anything to change that. I walked into the studio, and all the wrestlers were there. Junkyard Dog, sensing my nervousness, shouted, "Where's the hat, Jim?" referring to Watts, who always wore his big Western hat outside his home to maintain that cowboy persona. He lived his gimmick. My voice broke a little as I replied to Dog, "I'm running the interviews today." There was a little chuckle from the wrestlers. Grizzly couldn't resist joining in. "Yeah, Jim's running the interviews today," he said in a mocking, sarcastic tone. "This ought to be good." It was 10 a.m. when I walked past a studio full of tired, hungover, road-worn wrestlers who knew these promo spots would take most of the day. We weren't there to record one or two. We had to record dozens based on what towns and cities were on our loop. "We ready?" the cameraman asked. I knew all eyes were on me. Even though these interviews were hugely important, they needed to be conducted as quickly and professionally as possible. Studio time was paid for by the hour. Each feud shared a 3-minute interview slot that was usually captured in one take. Although sometimes there were issues that stopped that speed and slickness from happening. Some of those issues I could see coming from a mile away, while others weren't so obvious. I stood in front of a cheap cardboard backdrop with a single camera pointing at me. I was going to start by interviewing Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson of the Rock and Roll Express. "Jim," the cameraman asked, "we ready to shoot?" I nodded as I checked my notes. "Showtime. All the boys are watching. We do New Orleans first and take it from there," I replied. I could see the Rock and Roll Express moving closer, just off camera, getting ready to join me when the time was right. I wasn't really sure about their interview style yet, as they were pretty new to the company, having just come in via a recent trade with the Memphis Territory. As a matter of fact, a lot of people in the room had. A few months prior, the live gates were down a bit, and it was apparent to Watts that we needed some new faces. He reached out to Jerry Jarrett from the Memphis Territory and negotiated a trade deal to benefit both companies. The Memphis owners were invited by Watts to come to a couple of our shows to have a look around. The idea was that both Mid-South and Memphis could trade talents to freshen up their respective rosters and ignite fresh, new feuds to catch the audience's attention. As part of the negotiation process, Bill even went so far as to ask one of the Memphis owners to sit in with me to call a match. As a fan who regularly read the wrestling magazines, I was well aware of the King of Memphis. We had many mutual friends, so when I finally met Jerry Lawler in person, it felt like we already knew each other. Jerry had hundreds of hours of TV experience under his belt, so we meshed immediately and seemed to suit each other's style perfectly. He was easy to work with, glib, and knew what to say, and more importantly, knew what not to say. During the match, I tried more than once to catch King's eye, but he seemed to be more interested in surveying the women in the audience. He was scouting our territory, and the amount of women at the show was an indicator if the baby faces were over and doing their job for the female fans. When they'd seen enough, Lawler and his partner, Jerry Jarrett, both successful bookers, had a few pieces of advice. First, they said, in most cases, Bill's heels should be the baby faces and vice versa. It was an interesting point because we did have a lot of dynamic, athletic youngsters in villainous roles, while many of our protagonists were older, bulky brawlers. Part of the problem with that setup was that in those days, the babyface's duties frequently included servicing the female fans to keep them coming back and buying tickets. As the announcer, part of my job was to get across how much of a ladies' man a young hero was. They ended up making a talent trade to help the overstocked Jarrett clean out some of his mid-card and to help Mid-South get younger, new talents. The deal was simple. Memphis could have anyone except the Junkyard Dog, and Watts could have anyone but Lawler, manager Jimmy Hart, or the fabulous ones, Stan Lane and Steve Kern, who were the top tag team in Memphis. We agreed to send Rick Rude, who was just a rookie, Larry Hacksaw Higgins, and Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Watts went to Memphis to scout their talent, and in return with a list of names that would rejuvenate Mid-South, making 1984 its most profitable year. We received the Rock and Roll Express and their eventual rivals, the Midnight Express, Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey, with manager Jim Cornette. And it was through watching Cornette getting an ass-chewing from Watts that I learned one of the most valuable lessons about interviewing. Watts created the Midnight Express by taking Eaton, who is a middle-of-the-road babyface, and teaming him with Condrey, who is a heel about the same level as Eaton. Cornette, who had only been in the business for a little more than a year, was Memphis' secondary manager of bad guys behind perennial instigator Jimmy Hart. Cornette's gimmick was that of a rich mama's boy, a spoiled brat whose mother was spending her wealth on wrestlers for her obnoxious son to manage. When he came in to do his first interview on behalf of the team, I introduced Cornette with tremendous fanfare. I described him as the manager of one of the most skilled, controversial, sought-after teams in the world. Cornette blistered me with one-liners, one after another. He had seen that work for Jerry Lawler in Memphis, where the great announcer Lance Russell was such a beloved institution that making fun of him was enough to garner angst for a villain. Cornette made fun of my hair, my suit, my accent, and my home state. I never said a word, largely because there wasn't a second for me to say anything. It was an impressive display of verbal chops. Cornette barely seemed to take a breath. When the barrage was over, I had a brief opportunity to end the spot with, and the Midnight Express will debut this Saturday night in the Municipal Auditorium. We ended the spot, and Watts had some choice words for us, many of which began with the letter F. The last thing in my lifetime I want to see is you and my announcer wrestle a match, Bill told Cornette. Since I have no plans to book that for as long as I live, your clever diatribe didn't sell me one damn ticket. So we're going to do this again, and this time I want you to mention the name of the town, your opponents, and tell me a little about your team. Jim Ross gave you a hell of an introduction. He put your guys over, even though you're heels, because as representative of Mid-South, he's got no dog in the hunt. You need to focus on the guys who do, and those are your opponents. Cornette impressed me by not getting overwhelmed, by not taking the ass-chewing personally, and most of all, by showing that he truly got it. He took the Cowboys' instruction and delivered an excellent promo a few seconds later, when we did our second take. When it was over, Watts walked back over and told Cornette, "Now that was exactly what we need. If you can continue to improve on that and stay on that track, we're going to make a lot of money together." And Cornette did stay on that track. He recognized what a big break Watts had given him, a chance to be a villainous manager on a main event level. He was living his dream. And I learned a great lesson on who to focus on when interviewing, a lesson I was about to put to work as I stood in front of the camera on my own and waited for the Rock and Roll Express to join me. The cameraman counted us down. 3, 2. "And standing by with the Rock and Roll Express," I said as Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson stepped into the shot on cue, "who returned to New Orleans this Thursday to face Jim Cornette's Midnight Express." I could tell that both men were tired and a little cranky. Wednesdays were a real grind, with half the guys coming in from the previous night's show in Little Rock, more than 200 miles away, and the other half coming from a show in Louisiana. "Well," Ricky began, I had heard that Robert Gibson was also known as Hoot Gibson. I figured this nickname wasn't anything to do with trumpet playing abilities, but it did involve a skill. Simply put, Hoot could pride himself on lacing his and Ricky's long car journeys with the most vile, smelly farts known to modern man. These were the kind of hoots that were so disgustingly potent that they could actually make you angry from having to experience them. And as Ricky was also Robert's travel partner, they would drive hours to get to TV in a car filled with Robert's farts. To have a match, wait for their chance to promo over and over, just to get back in the car to make another town where Robert could again crop dust Ricky the whole way. "Fans are clamoring to see this epic confrontation, gentlemen," I said as I cut back in. Ricky was now looking distracted and a little lost. I continued, "And Ricky, I know that Robert's good friend, Junior, is especially concerned about the potential career-ending scenario that you two face this coming week. Well, Robert's good friend, Junior, was actually his penis. That's what he called it. So I thought referencing it might lighten the mood a little. I just want to get this done, Ricky said, obviously wanting another go at the promo. Okay, I said. We reset. The room was looking at us, waiting for us to get it done. Time was ticking, and a lot of large, tired men were waiting their turn. I raised my mic again. Fans are clamoring to see this epic confrontation, gentlemen. And Ricky, I know Robert's good friend, Junior, is especially concerned about the... Ricky interrupted me. No, I don't want... I just want to do it straight. Okay, sorry, I said. No more Junior. Ricky suddenly stared at his partner. Robert smiled a little as it looked like Ricky was about to kill him. I tried again. Fans are clamoring to see this epic confrontation, gentlemen, that could end up being a potential career-ending scenario for you in New Orleans this coming week. As I looked across both their faces, Ricky was now filled with rage, as Robert was a picture of pure joy. Gentlemen, I said, trying to get them both to focus on the job at hand. Oh, Jesus, Ricky said as he stormed out of the shot. You fucking asshole. This is bullshit. I'm done. I'm out of here. What just happened? I asked Robert, who was still standing beside me in the shot. Give it a second, he replied. I replayed my opening line back in my head in fear that I might have said something to piss off one member of the most popular tag team in the company. Ricky, I shouted, wait. And before I could finish my sentence, I got why Ricky was so pissed and Robert was so proud. When I say I got why Robert was so proud, I mean I got it straight in the eye. Yes, the eye. That bastard had conjured up a fart so toxic that it burned my eyes a little before it violated my nostrils. Robert's smile broke into a chuckle when he saw how much distress I was in. You need to get yourself checked out or something, I said, as I too stepped out of the shot. In truth, I was a little panicked, as a few months prior I had heard about the Bull Belinsky incident. Bull flashed his opponent off camera during an interview, and Cowboy, who saw it, fired Bull on the spot. No debate, no conversation. What happened? The cameraman whispered to me. Gibson poisoned us both. You didn't get that? I replied. Not yet, he said. You will. You think Bill saw? He's not here, the cameraman said. I smiled. You really believe that? Watts was watching from the control room. I knew he was. There was no way he was leaving me alone on my first outing. Jesus Christ, the cameraman said as he pulled his T-shirt over his nose. Told you, I said as I looked around to see if my boss was approaching me yet. But it wasn't my boss that was about to get hot. No wonder the houses are so small. This is the way we're doing a business, said a deep voice in the back of the room. Hacksaw Jim Duggan was waiting to cut his promos and wasn't happy about the waiting around. Ernie Ladd retorted, if you were over, we could draw the people into them arenas. Now, I got a situation where two ex-NFL players, two alpha males, who have probably never backed down in a confrontation in their lives, were getting ready to go nose to nose. If Cowboy was watching from the control room, I was praying for him to come out and save me. You want to step outside? Duggan asked Ernie from the other side of the room. Ernie rose from his seat, all 6'9" of him, and began to slowly walk toward Hacksaw. Hey, Jim, why don't you go out for a ride? I said as I walked into the path of both tough guys. Go on, clear your head, and we'll knock your stuff out later. The why don't you go for a ride line was something I saw Cowboy use a ton of times when guys would get pissed and unproductive. The wrestler would get in their car, and before they hit the road, clouds of smoke would be escaping from the open windows. Miraculously, the wrestler in question would come back perfectly chilled. Duggan left, Ernie sat down, and I wanted to go to a dark room and change my shorts. Ernie understood Duggan's frustration. Duggan was going out and having bloody brawls every night and working as snug and as violently as he could. After 7 straight nights of cutting his own forehead, Duggan's head was tender. His body was sore. And oftentimes, his money wouldn't be as much as he'd like it to be. By the 4th or 5th night on the road, Duggan could get the blood flowing without even using a blade, because by that point, a stiff shot from an opponent was sufficient enough to make him bleed. "Okay, are we all ready now?" I asked as I walked back into the camera. Robert Gibson was still there, and I could see Ricky walking back toward us. "Let's do this," I mumbled to the cameraman. Ricky stopped mid-stride. Robert smiled, and the cameraman covered his face again. "God damn it, Robert," Ricky shouted as he turned and walked away once more. Chapter 17, At the Top Table, 1984. People measured their rising worth in the wrestling business differently. Some of the boys knew the company was backing them when they got higher on the card, while others knew when their payoffs grew. I knew my stock was rising when I got to eat dessert with a big cat, Ernie Ladd. One of the office rituals after the promos was that Bill would sit with the booker to finalize our TV lineup and what was happening in the upcoming feuds. It was a small, closed club of 2, usually. "You coming, Jim?" Watt said to me after promos. "Me?" I asked. "Yeah," Ernie said as he waited by the door. "We're going to set you under the learning tree." I felt like running toward the boss and the booker, but I knew I had to keep my cool. Grateful, but not excited. Poised, but not cold on the invitation. The small closed club of 2 was open for one more, me. Not only was I back inside the wrestling world, I was learning more, taking on more, and giving more than I had done before. I had been to booking meetings previously, but mostly as a note taker for Leroy. This time, I was invited to be at the booking meeting. Give my opinion, listen, learn, and address what really made this business tick. The reasons why a certain person or a certain match was the right way to go. But before the booking came the eating. And both Cowboy and Ernie love to eat, buffet style. Now, normal portions of food weren't of interest to Ernie Ladd. As he walked to the buffet line, I could see him lick his lips right around the roast beef on display. The board server behind the counter didn't even look up before robotically asking, "What can I get you?" It was showtime for Ernie. Time for a little charm. To get a little extra. "Now you know you're feeding Ernie Ladd, young lady," he said to the 65-year-old server. She looked up to see the huge, handsome man in front of her. "I'm not like your scrawny little husband at home," he continued. "So how about a little more for the big cat? 'Cause you know," he whispered as he leaned over to her, "I'm 6'9", 320 pounds, and my feet's covers the ground I walks on." The servant lady coyly laughed. "Well, you know what else they say about a man with big feet." "He has big shoes?" Bill dryly answered, cutting into the middle of the flirtations. Ernie beamed his movie star smile back at her and walked away with twice the serving of any other person in the place. It was my turn next. "I'm Jim Ross," I said to the same lady, "and I'm..." She immediately cut me off. "Don't care," she said as she walked away. I stood in shock as I struggled to see what the difference was. I mean, apart from not having Ernie's looks, charm, charisma, stature, presence, we were all practically the same person. I rapidly left the counter, hoping no one else heard our interaction, and stopped at the dessert station on my way to the table. Cowboy and the big cat buzzsawed their way through their food as I cleared a small space for my apple cobbler a la mode. Both big men, both had big appetites. You're turning into the junk food dog, Ernie said to me. You need some real nourishment in your body. I knew he was right, but apple cobbler was my comfort food. It reminded me of home and my mama, who was the cobbler queen. You don't get far in this business eating ice cream, Ernie said. Real men eat lots of protein. I could see Cowboy trying not to laugh as he filled his mouth with meat and gravy. You ever fear a grown man who talked out of the side of his neck while eating ice cream? Ernie asked. No, me neither. When the big cat spoke, I still wasn't sure whether I should listen, reply, or take notes. Before I could choose either option, Ernie had moved on and was now waving to the server lady over my shoulder. He scooped some of my dessert into his fork and ate it. That's good, he said with a smile. You should have some. And have some, I did. If it was good enough for Ernie, it was good enough for me. Thing was, Big Cat was even more of a legendary figure to me because I knew who he was before either of us got into wrestling. He had played football for the Houston Oilers and Kansas City Chiefs, but his greatest football days may have been as a San Diego Charger, where he had led the team to 4 American Football League championships. As a kid, I had several of his football cards, so I was in awe of him when we first met. Because of his background, Ernie understood top-level athletes as few others did, and that meant he fit right into Bill's serious, sports-based approach. Apart from all the wisdom and logic, Ernie taught me about the wrestling business. He also taught me about life as an African-American, something I never got to hear too much of in my hometown. When I was a child in Oklahoma, it was illegal for African-Americans to live anywhere they wanted in the county. Not because of the beliefs of the people who lived there at that time, but because of one of those old segregation laws. I grew up with a law in my county that literally said it was illegal for a black man to see the sunset while standing in Adair County. Maybe it was due in part to my mother's Native American ancestry, but I was not raised in a racist household. Some of the Caucasians viewed Native Americans as another race, just as they viewed African Americans. My parents raised me to see that kind of prejudice as embarrassing, but because of the homogeneous nature of Adair County's demographics, I grew up not understanding the plight of African American people, especially in the tumultuous 1960s. Giving all people civil rights and equal treatment just seemed like a no-brainer to me. As a kid, I always made a point of listening to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when one of his speeches was being broadcast. The day after, I'd look into the papers for snippets of his words or full transcripts if I could get them. The young wordsmith in me considered those speeches a treat, as much for his presentation and the poetry of his language as for his message of equality. He compelled me to think about other people's lives, other people's experiences, and he did it in my preferred way, with spoken elegance and impact. In his own way, Ernie was also a trailblazer. He was the first major African-American wrestling villain in the 1960s, when most promoters were scared that such a thing would lead to race riots in the arenas. Even by the time I came to wrestling, each territory had no more than 1 or 2 black wrestlers in featured positions, and never as the main event. Except in Mid-South, where Watts used both a black booker in Ernie and a black top star in JYD. Watching Ernie's work had already taught me tremendous lessons about getting across a point in a promo, just as he, the person, taught me about what it meant to live with the prejudice he had confronted his whole life. It's not enough for people to hear the noise. They must also take in the message, Ernie told me. We make them feel something, good or bad. And I sat there listening to two of the best ever, laying out the territory and polishing their finer points. When he was done both booking and eating, Ernie rubbed his belly, stood up from the table. "You taking me home?" he asked Bill. Cowboy shook his head a little in disbelief. "Drive yourself home," Watts replied. "Come on," Ernie said as he turned and walked out of the cafeteria a few steps ahead of us. "Why does he want you to take him home?" I asked Bill as we followed behind. "Watch," Watts replied. When we got down into the parking lot, Ernie stood beside his navy blue Lincoln Continental with the driver's door open. Bill had given Ernie the car for a job well done. "The hat is driving," Ernie said, using his nickname for Bill. "Junk food can set shotgun, and I'll take the back seat. Sound good?" Bill laughed and did just as he was told. "What's happening?" I whispered before he got in the car. Bill didn't have time to explain before we were all seated, just as Ernie wanted. "Now," said the big cat, as Bill started the car, "take me to the hotel, Mr. Driver." I learned as we drove that Ernie got a big kick out of having a, quote, a big white driver take him around town as people looked on. Bill also got as much fun out of it as his big black brother in the back seat. I had no idea on that day that Ernie was winding down his time as a booker. He was burnt out on the business and ready to transition to his beloved ministry work. But not before he got the hat to drive him for the small town to see. When Ernie left the business, we got our next booker from Memphis, superstar Bill Dundee. It was a huge boost for us. Watts brought Dundee in strictly to book the shows, but wouldn't let Bill wrestle. Watts' concern was that the 5'7 Aussie would book himself to conquer Watts' tough giants. Bill just didn't see it as realistic, and if it wasn't real, then Bill didn't want it on his TV show. Dundee continued to badger Watts. "You can wrestle," Watts said. "I can. I'm sick of listening to you. I knew you'd see sense. But the second I see you trying to make yourself the centerpiece," Watts said, "I'm pulling you out of there." "Deal," Dundee replied. "Deal," Watts said with a handshake. Within a month, Dundee tried to put himself in featured roles, and Bill pulled him back out again. But as a booker, Dundee helped concoct some incredible stories and feuds. Dundee pushed for smaller, higher-paced wrestlers to get more prominent positions. The Rock and Roll Express, the Fantastics, Terry Taylor, Dennis Condrey, and Bobby Eaton, with manager Jim Cornette, all began to rise to the top of the cards and pull the audience with them. It was a noticeable shift away from the huge football player types that have become a staple of the territory. Apart from bookers, Cowboy was also shaking things up with his announcers, too. One week, Boyd Pierce would become the ring announcer, and I would handle the play-by-play as Bill's son Joel served as color commentator. We'd take the between-show breaks and then settle in for the second show of the taping, only now I was ring announcer, and Boyd and Bill called the matches for the TV audience. Despite his youth, Joel knew what the boss wanted, because Joel had grown up under his roof. Joel put together the amazing videos for his father's shows. Besides my increasingly frequent TV announcing duties, I continued to be a bigger part of the booking meetings. My theory on how to contribute to the creative direction was pretty simple. If I saw Bill writing something on a yellow legal pad he always brought with him, it would behoove me to do the same, because Bill wasn't going to waste energy by writing down a meaningless point. One day, when I saw him simply write the letters J-Y-D in his pad, I knew something was up. The junk food dog was getting more and more entrenched in the company. But the real junkyard dog had already made a deal to leave. Chapter 18, Changes from New York, 1984. I was spending more and more time in the bubble of the wrestling business. My parents were getting divorced, and my own marriage began to wobble again. The business began to reestablish itself as my obsession, my reason for getting up in the morning and going to bed late at night. I was learning, hustling, and moving up in the company. But I was putting my family, my daughter, into second place because of the long hours and the chaotic lifestyle. I worked in front of the camera and behind it. I was making sales, promoting events. Mid-South was my life. And as I was burying myself in deeper, the company's top star had tunneled himself a way out. Without saying a word to anyone, Junkyard Dog signed with WWF. No notice, no nothing. Wrong on all fronts. Even before Vince McMahon began his national push, the New York territory had always been the goal for most pro wrestlers. WWF shows were in the most densely populated areas in the country, which meant the crowds were bigger, which meant the payoffs were better than virtually any other territory. No one could fault a person for moving on to better money. But in the wrestling business, there was a way to move on, a way to do it right. As we sat and wrote TV, Watts veered from angry to reflective, to dejected. "You don't do that," he said. "You don't just walk out on the territory that made you a star without giving notice, without making a star out of someone else on your way out." We had all the other segments written, but Bill wanted to leave some space in the show to talk to the folks at home. As the red light came on at the taping, I had no idea what was going to be said, but I knew it wasn't going to be flattering to Junkyard Dog. As I introduced the show to the audience at home, Bill sat beside me at the desk with a headset on and a little slip of paper in his hand. Bill raised the subject of JYD and said, quote, "Junkyard Dog was a great superstar for a lot of time. And I think a lot of the pressure that Butch Reed put on him maybe, finally, affected Dog. The only thing I disagree with here is he made a lot of obligations and let the fans down. He's been under the gun for 5 years, and Butch Reed is an awesome individual, and apparently it kind of made JYD crack or do something, and he sought greener pastures, so to speak. We don't know. This is all summation and speculation, but certainly JYD's not here, and JYD did not show up at the matches he was booked against Butch Reed. And, of course, Reed and Landell are going to take a lot of credit for that. We then cut to Boy Pierce, who was in the ring with one of the toughest men alive, Dr. Death Steve Williams. I watched Cowboy try to pretend that his feelings weren't hurt. Mid-South is known as the toughest competitive wrestling area in the world today, Cowboy continued on commentary. By all the wrestlers themselves, they acknowledge that area is the finest, is the toughest. Hacksaw Butch Reed seems to have surpassed, with the tremendous pressure he's put on, probably the greatest athlete I've seen in a long time in wrestling. For all JYD's personal problems to apparently cause him to not want to answer the challenge, continuous pressure by Hacksaw Reed. I chimed in the action. Dr. Death has that big tree-like arm wrapped around the neck of Mike Jackson. Throughout the show, Cowboy continued his severe burial. His biggest star had left with no notice. Bill had to spin the situation back to his advantage as much as he could. Traditionally, if a territory star left, he helped make the next star on his way out. Bill was livid that JYD would leave in a way that showed no respect for the boys. the territory that had made him a star, or for the business in general. No matter what Bill thought of another promoter, he would never have wanted a guy coming into Mid-South to skip out on a place he was leaving. But I knew, as I watched him, that what hurt Cowboy the most was that Dog broke a bond that he and Bill had. Sylvester Ritter, the person, was special to the big Cowboy. And when he left, Bill felt like he had lost a family member. A family member who had just simply walked out and left him high and dry. I found out that in wrestling, true friendships weren't all that easy to come by. I also found out when Cowboy came off camera that his mind immediately veered into the business end of the situation. "We're not going to get that last match out of the Dog, so we can't build a new star that way," Bill said. "Who else we got coming up? We got to keep our territory fresh, come up with something new." Watts wasn't going to lie down and let his ticket sales take a hit. He knew in wrestling that if you're coasting, you're dying. The biggest enemy to any wrestler, booker, and company in general was the dreaded comfort zone. Wrestling was all about the next new thing. And the next new thing was coming. But it was coming from New York. WrestleMania? What the hell is the WrestleMania? I heard Watts Secretary George Ennis say Paul Bosch had called and told Watts that New York was planning something big, something that could succeed hugely or pull down the new young promoter who was attempting it. Despite the skepticism and cynicism from those around him, Cowboy knew it was going to be good for everyone if this idea hit. "I knew it was good for our business, too, as I was the person responsible for selling the Mid-South TV show in new syndicated markets. Up until then, station managers didn't have that much product knowledge. Wrestling was wrestling to them. But once WrestleMania came along, those station managers could see that wrestling was cool, getting a lot of mainstream exposure and nudging its way back into the public psyche again. Watts put me on the road even more to sell our show to stations around the region. I might be interested in wrestling again, but of all the shows out there, why should I buy yours?" the station manager at WWL-TV asked me. I knew the question well and also knew how to answer it. "Would you mind," I said, handing over a document from my briefcase. I had the numbers of their own rating service, Nielsen and Arbitron, ready to go. "As you can see, our shows do really well in other established markets," I said. I could tell by his face as he read the numbers that he was surprised at the ratings and shares that we were earning. These were legitimate numbers, using their own terminology and service to measure a viewership that turned heads. After a few months, I was doing so well that I couldn't keep up. I had to talk to Cowboy about getting a little help to sell. The World Wrestling Federation was helping all ships rise on this ambitious wave. And as much as I liked selling and making some decent money, my eyes were drawn to New York for different reasons. I wanted in someday, too. Chapter 19, The Greatest, 1985. The fastest, most precise punches I have ever witnessed were kissing the side of my face. "I ain't afraid of no snake. He better not get in my face for his own sake," said the man who was throwing them. I was put on assignment to shadow the 3-time world heavyweight champion in his home in Los Angeles for a couple of days. Muhammad Ali was coming to Mid-South, and he was practicing his working punches on my generous round face. "Boom, boom," Ali said as he threw perfect right after perfect right. It was day 3, and I had gotten so used to his sudden outburst of punches that I was no longer fearful for my life. "I'm going to throw a right," Ollie said, and he did just that. "And then I'm going to throw a left." Ollie did just that. "And then I'm going to eat this sandwich," Ollie said as he suddenly sat down and finished his lunch. "You want to see some magic?" he asked as he wiped his mouth. His energy was boundless. "Watch this," he said as he reached into his pocket. He took out a coin and chomped down onto it, biting the coin in half. "You see that?" he asked. In fact, I had seen it by him the day before and the day before that. "And watch," Ollie said as he blew the coin and it matched back together again. "Oh my," I said, trying to muster up the same level of wonderment as I had the first few times. "How do you do that?" "It's a miracle," he replied. "I bring miracles with me everywhere I go." He wasn't wrong. I could have watched the same tricks over and over for a month. It wasn't the trick. It wasn't the miracle. It was the delivery. It was the presence. It was the childlike joy Ali got from it. Muhammad Ali knew something that was intrinsic to the wrestling business. It wasn't what you were selling. It was how you sold it. The same principle wasn't working back in Mid-South for Cowboy, who was trying to replace his top star. Even though Watts had replaced JYD with a similarly jacked African-American man, the Snowman wasn't JYD. Not in the charisma department, nor the box office department. So Cowboy was bringing in Ali as a special attraction for the Big Dome Show to finally try and make the Snowman a star in the fans' eyes. Watts knew his new pick needed a lot of rub, so he hired Ali and his spiritual advisor, Boudini Brown, to help corner the Snowman. Across the ring would be Despicable Jake the Snake Roberts with a huge Barbarian in his corner. It was all to build to a spot where Barbarian's interference necessitated Ali's involvement to level out the playing field. Behind the scenes, Jake, who was the real-life son of Grizzly Smith, was not entirely thrilled with Ali's role in the match. Jake wanted to make sure Ali knew how to throw working punches, the kind a wrestler would throw in a match, so as to not do actual damage. That was why Ali was peppering me with bunches of fluttering working punches in L.A. Bill had asked me and his son Joel to fly out to the Champ's house and capture some vignettes with Ali for the upcoming TV shows. "I want to show you something," the Champ said as he walked down his massive hallway. I immediately followed. Anything Ali thought interesting enough to show me, I was going to look at. I watched him walk and noticed, even though he was only retired 4 years, that he was a little more unsteady, a little slower than I remembered from his boxing days. We ended up in the huge attic of his house, where I spotted title belts and gifts from world leaders and celebrities flowing out of boxes that they were informally packed in. "Look at all this stuff," he said with a smile. One of the boxes had the corner of a gold garment hanging out. "You like that?" he asked as he saw my eyes drawn to the gold. I wasn't even sure what it was. "Does your mama like Elvis?" Ali asked as he hurried to the box and pulled out a gold jumpsuit. "Absolutely she does," I replied. "Why don't you take that home to her?" he said as he handed it to me. "Because I'm sure she would love it." "What is it?" I asked as I held it at arm's length to get a better look. The Champ replied, "That's a jumpsuit that Elvis gave me in his dressing room after one of his Las Vegas Hilton shows. It's never even been cleaned, so his sweat is still on it." "Champ, I can't take this," I said as I tried to hand it back. "It just wouldn't be right." "You can have it," he said. "No, I really couldn't." "All right," he said as he dug through another box. "But it's there if you change your mind." Having something belonging to Elvis wasn't a big deal to the Champ, nor was being generous. He just wanted to show a stranger from Oklahoma some real cool things from down through the years. His belts, his robes, photographs, magazines, they were all just lying there. That evening, with a chance permission, I used his home phone to call my mom, Colette, in Oklahoma. She was totally in agreement that I should not be rude enough to take a precious gift from the champ. Truth is, I also wanted to call home so that I could obtain Ollie's home phone number, which would show up on Mom's phone bill at the end of the month. I didn't want to share the number with another living soul, nor would I ever call it, but I did certainly want to have bragging rights to my friends back home in Oklahoma that I had the personal phone number of the greatest. We spent our week shooting vignettes and promos, practicing the working punch and talking about everything. Ollie would begin a thought, and 20 minutes later, I would be even more engaged than I was at the beginning. He had a way of crafting a position, a story, a life lesson, and wrapping it around the most entertaining delivery. I knew I was blessed to be in Ollie's presence, and wrestling put me there. I learned a lot. I met an idol, spent time in his home, took his punches, watched his magic tricks, but most of all, I listened. "Goodbye, my Oklahoman friend," he said to me as I was leaving on the final day. We had the footage we needed, and our job at the Chance House was done. "Yeah," I said, not really wanting to leave. "Want to see a magic trick?" he asked. I dropped my bags and followed him back to his house. Chant didn't have to ask twice. He seemed happy to have the company, and I was happy to spend some more time with him. Elvis Presley's gold jumpsuit remained in the possession of Muhammad Ali, but the champ and I would reconvene several weeks later in New Orleans at the Hyatt Regency across from the Superdome. We shared a two-bedroom suite with a common living area for 3 days and nights while doing media and PR for the Dome Show. Bill even managed to get Ali a one-day gig back in Oklahoma at a rich oil man's son's birthday party for a cool $25,000. Cowboy even flew Ali to the birthday party on Watt's private plane. As Muhammad Ali and I walked down Bourbon Street together, he was like the Pied Piper, as patrons and entertainers alike filed out of the colorful New Orleans establishments and followed us up and down the historic section of the city. I watched as Ali talked to person after person about our big Dome Show. He rhymed and laughed and charmed. One by one, group by group, they were buying tickets to see the champ skin that snake. The crowds got so intense around us that our only way out was to ride back to the Hyatt in a police vehicle. It was only when I got inside the hotel that I realized the champ had invited back a group of people so that he could regale stories, show them magic tricks, and talk to them until the early hours. When the big cowboy arrived in New Orleans the next morning, he took one look at me and said, "What in the hell have you been doing? You look like death." I had no issue telling my boss that I was simply trying to keep up with Muhammad Ali, and it was proving to take a lot more stamina than I had as a mere mortal. Ali had the most amazing motor of anyone I had ever met or ever been around in my lifetime. We had hours of chats about women, lots of women, racism, our country's future, Frazier, Foreman, promoters, how he and his camp made extra money in an era when boxing stars, especially black boxing stars, still did not make what they deserved or earned. We talked extensively about food and the wonderful meals that our mothers prepared for us growing up, Ali in Louisville and me in Oklahoma, and how much we loved going to Dookie Chase's restaurant in New Orleans. I also found out firsthand how big a fan of pro wrestling Ali was, especially the promo skills of Gorgeous George and Freddie Blassie. "I heard them wrestlers talk," he said.